Accession number 23329, reel 21.
Mr. Kerlyonga, reel 21.
Variably, the army parties were unmolested when they left the camp, while the RAF men would be detained at the gate and searched for cigarettes, which the Germans knew they would use for bribes. Often the RAF parties were kept so long until it was too late to go into the woods. When we got to the stage that we had nothing in the room to burn, Buck led a party of us into the darkness to dig up a post from the fence, which was between our compound and the main compound. That is, it wasn't a perimeter fence. But nevertheless, we had to time the swing of the searchlights. We needed to be alert for an unexpected traverse, and also, of course, we had to have a lookout to warn us of dogs or patrolling guards. So we dug and we heaved. Groaning with his effort, used his shoulder as a battering ram to loosen the post, and in the end we got it and we left the wire hanging slack. When we got this huge post into the room, we went to work on it with a crosscut saw, a hatchet, kitchen knives, and razor blades. The crosscut saw and the hatchet had been stolen from the German tool shed at some point. It was not very long before the Germans came to look for the post. By the time they got there and got to us, it was stacked in faggots against the wall. There were chips and sawdust all over the floor. But typically, the guards had been told to look for a 12-foot post. They took no notice of the chips or the sawdust or the fresh pile of faggots, and they went on to search the next hut. It was always the aim of the Germans to stir up trouble between the RAF and the army prisoners, and they even doctored news bulletins with allegations that the Allied ground and air forces were at loggerheads and deliberately withholding support from each other. The Germans actually issued a news sheet, and the propaganda might have succeeded had we not enjoyed the daily BBC news bulletins. What's more, the news sheet issued to us provided the readers of the BBC reports with excellent cover if they should be caught at their work. Much of the German news was a rehash of the bulletins to the German people, and we soon learned the formula for glossing over bad news. Whenever the German armies retreated, the news would read something like, the focal point of the fighting shifted from Schloss Kosolowitz, or some similar name, to Eskana Vakanovich, or some similar name. And these would be the names of tiny villages that few people would bother to look up on the map, and probably wouldn't find them if they did. So a perfectly true statement implied that nothing important had happened. But if the German people had investigated the whereabouts of those villages, they'd find probably they were 50 miles or so apart, and between them several important towns, or a name such as Torn might pop up for the first time and would read something like, heavy fighting took place near the town of Torn. Next day there was further fighting in the Torn area. Russian attacks in great strength were contained. Then another day it was, fierce fighting is still going on in the outskirts of the town of Torn. After that, the word town would be dropped, fortress substituted, the word garrison crept in, and we knew the town was surrounded. And finally, it would be admitted that the fortress had succumbed, but the last-ditch heroism of the German troops would be acclaimed, and I'm sure they deserved it. And, the day came, it was December the 15th, when the German bulletin recounted not defeat, but a sudden and fierce counterattack, and this was Ardennes. And we didn't know whether this was the last shot in the locker, or whether it foreshadowed a revitalized Germany. So we had a very anxious wait until the 26th, when the German armored columns were halted near the Meuse. Well, Christmas came, and we knew that this would be the last Christmas of our imprisonment. We'd reckoned each Christmas in the past would be our last, but this time there was no doubt, despite Ardennes. And it wasn't a happy time, even so. The Ardennes situation did cause a lot of disappointment, and because of our malnutrition and the darkness and the dampness, bitterness had grown up among some of us. Then we were given generously by the neighbouring camp, 11B, 2,500 food parcels, enough for a quarter of a parcel per man. And we were able to make plum duff from potatoes, grating them and then squeezing them in muslin, so that we were left with a sticky pink suet, to which we added prunes, and we all had thundering belly aches. Celebrated the new year with more gusto because the Ardennes offensive had been halted. And we were allowed the lights until midnight. But at the turn of the year, I was sitting in the latrine and growing anxious in case I was shot on my return journey to the barrack. At past midnight, I crept outside and saw on the horizon what appeared to be a fireworks display, but in fact must have been tracer being fired at our bombers. We ate the remainder of the Christmas handout on New Year's Day, and it was my bath day. The fuel we had enabled us to keep the stove going for a short time in the evening, and there was hot water enough to allow each man a keg of it once in 9 days. There was not room in the keg, which measured 12 inches in height and 8 in diameter, for even 1 foot to stand flat. You stripped, and then balancing on the toes with the heel hard against the side of the keg, you tried to sluice your body in such a way that the water spilled back, for the same water had to serve for laundry. The clothes we tried to dry by wrapping them around the hot iron chimney pipe, where usually they scorched without seeming to dry at all. The discussion in the variable queue for the chimney tended to be acrimonious because the drying process was a long one, and so was your wait for your turn. In everything we did, we seemed to think more of our own welfare and less and less frequently that of anybody else. Hardship brought out the worst in many of us, but some men, and often they were men who in ordinary days we hadn't thought much of, met the challenge with great moral strength. On January the 14th, we found that to reach the parade ground, we had to pass through a lane of machine gunners. And when we formed our usual hollow square for counting, the guards closed in, and machine gun stations and dogs were stationed all around us. One prisoner, arriving a bit late, raised his hat and asked a German officer if there was anything unusual afoot. Finally, a German officer, not the commandant, if I remember rightly, marched onto the parade ground, and he unrolled a lengthy proclamation, and he read out allegations against British officers running a POW camp in Egypt. And the high command had decided on reprisals, therefore, and these were to be taken against prisoners of our particular camp. So there was quite a list of reprisals. Our tables and benches were to go, so that meant nothing to sit on and nothing to put food on. Our palliasses were to go, and half our bedboards, which meant that we were left with 3 feet of bare board to lie on. The library was to be closed, and all sporting materials were to be confiscated. Not that there was much use for sporting materials in that winter. The hut in D compound, which had been promised for a theatre, would be used to store the confiscated palliasses. I don't think we would ever have got the theatre anyway. The officer concluded that the order had not originated in the commandanture of the camp, but was a decree of the high command. And he said he was sure we would accept the measures with typical British stoicism. So the Kriegers gave 3 cheers for the German officers, and another for the German High Command. And we heard cheers from R&B compound parades as well. The Germans seemed totally nonplussed by this, and they forgot to count us. By the time we got back to the huts, tables and forms were already being carried out to motor lorries, which were lined up outside the barracks. Then came the palliasses and bedboards. We were massed around the lorries, and some of our diehards tried to seize palliasses, but the Germans were in an ugly mood, and most people realized that it was better not to provoke them. Buck, however, did get a palliasse, and he managed to slide it onto the roof. It went unnoticed for some time, but eventually was taken. So he reported sick and persuaded the doctors to give him a chit which certified that on medical grounds he should have a palliasse. The edict had exempted the sick from the reprisal, and the medical officers gave as many chits as they dared to the sick, and also to those wise beings like Buck who laid claim to ill health. The rest of us, well, we were left with those five thin, bare planks. In fact, they covered no more than 2 feet 6 inches. It was impossible to sleep on that, so the boards had to be distributed along the length of the bunk to form a sort of grid. When we were at Heiderkrug, we'd been able to support a palliasse when bedboards were taken there by using cardboard to reinforce the bedboards. But here we had no palliasse and no cardboard either, come to that. So it was a time of uncomfortable nights, because the boards tended to slip away in both directions, and you folded in the middle and fell through onto the floor if you were in a lower bunk, and onto the man in the bunk underneath if you were on the higher one. Some people tried sleeping two to a bunk and combining their bedboards, but the bunks were really too narrow for that. In the daytime, in the gloom, the men sitting everywhere on upturned kegs. I can't remember where we got those kegs, but anyway we did. And we sat around like smugglers in their caves. Dick, almost in despair, wrote in his diary, "Without his pit to sit on or lie in, the Krieg is finished." An awful day when the compound was deep in snow, and the snow was still whirling in the wind. I went for a bit of a walk, and I witnessed, wasn't a fight, it was a beating up. There was a young army man between two other army men who were hitting him without any retaliation from him. I saw two huge blows struck, and the boy wasn't attempting to defend himself. down he went, and I almost couldn't believe what I was seeing. It was absolutely pitiless, and it was frightening. The man in front of me turned as if he was sensing disapproval, and he said he stole bread. And the man, or young man, got up again. They too, men who were doing the beating up, were waiting for him to get up again, which he did, and they felled him once more, and this time he didn't get up. A trek cart came from the sick bay. It was on sleigh runners instead of wheels. He was flung onto that, and I noticed that as the trek cart was hauled away, a man picked up from the snow the parachutist beret. He was a man from Arnhem, and he quite gently placed the beret on the unconscious man. I went round a corner and was sick. I hoped there wouldn't be any more brutality of that kind, but we realised something was happening outside the barrack at about the same time, for some sort of procession. We could hear cheering, and we guessed that somebody had stolen food and was about to be punished. A roommate of the thief came into our barrack. He was not going to take part in the procession, but he did approve it. He said it isn't as if it was the first time he was caught before. He said, I mean, what can you do with a bloke like that? The man was hoiked down to the latrine. There was a concrete trapdoor over the cesspit, which was evacuated each week by the honey wagon, as we called it, and he was chucked into it fully clothed, eventually allowed to clamber out. He was told to go to the little wooden shed that I mentioned earlier, and there he was hosed with ice cold water, and it was a long time before all the filth was washed away. I had seen only the beginning and the end of this episode, and I felt that however mean the theft, this man's courage in facing punishment hadn't been surpassed even by the young paratrooper. They at least had used fists, which we usually consider honourable weapons. This one just heaped humiliation on him. And there were other instances of similar punishment, but I didn't see them. Cases of theft in the normal days, when we'd had Red Cross parcels, were very rare, if they occurred at all. But now, in this bitter, hungry winter, men, often to their own feelings of shame, tended to magnify the smallest dishonesty and meted out pretty harsh punishment. It was happening all over the compound. Cases of pettifogging little thefts. But when you consider that there were 10,000 men, all desperately hungry, it caused, I suppose, some feeling of tolerance, and one wondered what would happen if one's own friends were to succumb to sudden temptation. An answer came to this pretty quickly. Our room leader, Bill Bohill, he who had saved me from the Germans who didn't like my art, took me aside, and he told me that one of the inmates of the hut, boy about 20, well educated, well mannered, a boy who was normally thoughtful and smiling, had gradually let himself drift until now he become sly and unhappy, and he'd stolen 3 potatoes. And in doing so, he'd lost the respect and affection of his friends. That it wasn't the first time he'd done it, and they suspected him and laid a trap for him. Bill asked me, "What do you think we should do about it?" I suggested a pep talk. He said, "No rough stuff." And I said, "No rough stuff." "And that's what I was hoping you'd say," he said. "The fellows he stole from have left it to me and agreed to tell no one about it. So I wanted to get a sort of cross-section of opinion in the room. You, Dick, Toby, Buck, Morris, Fisher, maybe one or two more. Don't tell anyone else." Well, I thought about Bill's cross-section, and it seemed to me that he was carefully excluding less tolerant men. I don't know, he may have taken aside every man in the barrack. But he knew well that if he'd stood in front of the 70 men in the room and announced that there was a thief in the room, what should we do with him? I think the response of the mass would have been the procession to the latrine. Awful conditions in the huts, roofs leaking increasingly, ever the green slime on the grey walls. Health began to deteriorate. Influenza was rife, and septicemia in the hand particularly was frequent. Dick suffered first. His index finger on the right hand swelled to the size of a sausage and throbbed alarmingly, and next day he was admitted to the sick bay and was operated on. Toby and I visited him several times. About a week later, I was in the same ward. My hand was so bloated that only the tips of the fingers protruded. I was operated on by a Dr. Kildare, sort of Captain Todd, and eventually, as I drifted out of my unconscious state with a prize, I had a prize hangover from the anaesthetic which had been injected into the vein. Dick kept whistling to make me lift my head, and laughing when I had to let fall back on the pillow. I forget what the anaesthetic actually was, but if I remember, it used to be given to women in labour, full stop. I asked Captain Todd why so many of us were down with septicemia, and he said really it was due to malnutrition and our general rundownness, only needed a small cut or something, and the infection could easily set in.